Jan Smith is one of the most sought-after premier vocal coaches and producers in the music industry. She describes herself as a personal trainer for vocal athletes. Her musical career began 30 years ago as a rock and roll singer and songwriter. Building on her transition into coaching musicians, Jan Smith Studios now serves more chart-topping artists than any other vocal facility in America. Her team has coached over 4,000 vocalists, musicians, and producers. Professionals like Robert Thomas, Sugarland, India Arie, Drake, and Justin Bieber seek out her technical artistry, tough love training, and music industry expertise. Grammy winner Usher affectionately calls her Mama Jan. Jan Smith was one of the first vocal coach producers to earn a Grammy nomination for the song Born to Be Somebody in Justin Bieber's documentary movie Never Say Never. She has been inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, and Billboard named her one of the top 100 women in the music business. There's a great deal of change in the music industry these days with new technologies and avenues of access, and I'm eager to welcome a woman who can enlighten us. Thank you, Jan, for sharing this time with us today.
My pleasure.
So tell us about Jan Smith, the kid. Were you precocious when you were young?
I don't know if precocious is a good word. I think I was different. Definitely walked outside of the lines of the norm because I grew up being gifted in sound and sought that as my drummer. So I was harmonizing.
When you say gifted in sound, what do you mean by that?
Sound was always natural to me, hearing in color, hearing harmonies. I harmonized with my mom's vacuum cleaner when I was two and sang and just made up songs and kind of lollygagged along the music trail most of my life. So
that phrase, hearing in color, what does that mean? How do you see color in sound?
Harmonies and arrangements of different, like orchestration, for example, hearing dimensionally, the same way that some people are gifted in sight. For example, there are people who are designers and they're able to pull a room together really well, or people who I think that fashion stylists are incredibly talented because I can't even dress myself right because I don't know really from an accessory standpoint, but I hear things that other people don't hear. So being able to distinguish things like that.
Harmonizing with the vacuum cleaner at 2 years old. So how old were you then when you wrote your first song?
I was nine, actually.
Really?
I probably wrote bits and pieces of other songs when I was five, six, and seven, just, you know, singing and making things up, but wrote my first official song when I was 9 years old.
And was it, did you perform it?
I was a kid growing up in Southern Baptist churches, and from there learned, all the gospel songs, but then went to a girl summer camp and learned how to play ukulele. So that was my first real, instrument. And from
now,
there.
Now, do you play by ear?
I do.
All of the instruments that you, because you play more than one.
I do play I play several. The only instrument that I'm formally trained on is flute. I learned that in high school, in elementary school up to high school band.
So is that the classical training part that you were referring
to? Well, classical training on flute, and then also flute and orchestra and symphonic band, and then also in choruses. I was the kid that grew up in chorus and was at Allstate and all of that stuff. So, yeah.
So then you start playing with a rock and roll band.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about that.
Well, growing up in the 50s and 60s, rock and roll kind of became the focus of music, especially with the Beatles, invading when I was a little kid. And the Woodstock era, in 69 or so, introduced us to rock music. And so as a kid with a guitar, Joni Mitchell was really my greatest influence, and that was the Woodstock era introduction. And from there, it was... the thing to do was to play in rock and roll bands, so that's what I did.
And then the disco era came in, though. So
the disco era killed original rock music for me. I graduated college in 1978, and right around the disco era, it was hard to even get arrested if you were playing original rock music. So so I ended up, I worked as a psychologist for 8.5 years for the state of Georgia in DeKalb County. Yeah, that's my formal degree, and fed myself and afforded my band and myself the opportunity to record in studios and to continue my work as an original artist until people started to listen to real rock again.
So you were writing, recording, touring with your band. How in the world then did you get into coaching?
I think there was, you mentioned something about a guitar shop down on Ponce de Leon or something.
There's a music store called Clark Music, and I was talking to Bob, the guy who owns the store, and was looking for a drum machine because I wanted to record just some demos at home and wanted to be able to learn about programming, so I was talking to him about a drum machine. It was a gentleman next door to Clark Music on Ponce de Leon that owned the Atlanta School of Rock, which was they were, you know, Steve Dukes was the gentleman teaching rock and roll guitar artists how to play better, and making it more of a formalization versus just, you know, taking rock guitar serious. So for me, I was looking for a drum machine. I walked next door and talked to him about the one he had for sale. And he, and just in talking to him, he figured out who I was. As I'd been known around town as a girl with, you know, some singing chops. And he asked me if I could help one of his guitar students who was losing his voice to perhaps strengthen his voice and find out what was wrong. And I said, sure, I'll, you know, give it a shot. That with my first client, who was a young man in a band called the Torpedoes. They were a very popular band at the time. And from there, it just... Nobody was really catering to the needs of rock and roll singers or street singers or urban singers at the time. It was all classical instruction, and that the vernacular of that was not very conducive to rock and urban artists. So being able to create a dialogue, if you will, and bridge that gap between my knowledge as a rock, you know, singer, and then helping them understand some things maybe they needed to on the technical side without it sounding so technical or classical, and making it applicable to their art form, seemed to click with people. And 27 years later, well, here you go.
Wow. 27 years later, you own and operate a state-of-the-arts vocal coaching artist development facility, probably one of the best known in the country, if not the best in America. A 2-year waiting list. Oh my gosh, exactly what do you do as a vocal coach to make someone wait for 2 years to see you?
I don't know.
I mean, and you're not doing just what the average vocal coach does, because, you know.
You know, God has blessed the work of my hands pretty extensively, and I'm grateful for that, and it humbles me tremendously that people wait that long, and they do. But I think it's the personalized service that myself and my staff have, a very gifted staff who have all been mentored by me. But it's about the personal service, meeting people where they are, really helping them to raise their bars. And I kind of think that what we do is we broker people's dreams by the day and help them just to be better at what they're doing. Mm-hmm. What they want to excel at, that's what we do best at. And therein lies the magic, if there is any.
So you work with, tell me about some of the things you deal with, the breathing, the warm-ups, all of that. What technically are some of the things that you
You know what, all of those things are important. If you look at it and separate it out from, you know, the aesthetic or the spiritual, the emotional part of singing, what we're really doing is training vocal athletes. And the same way that you would take a person who is training for the Olympics, there are certain things that they need to go through to get their bodies in shape and to condition for a certain athletic event. Well, singing and performing and being in the studio and touring, there are certain things that people need to be able to condition to be able to have the stamina and also to have the performance acumen that they need to be able to perform in those arenas. And that's what we do, is break it down to make it accessible. And then also specializing in very particular techniques for those singers who might be in you know, R&B music versus rock music versus heavy metal versus country.
That's curious. Well, it's curious to me, because I was wondering if it takes a different technique to teach or to coach a jazz vocalist versus a country or rock vocalist.
So yes, there are different things involved in the stylizings that go along with different types of music, and being well-versed in all of those is important with the different artists that come in. But at the end of the day, there are certain things that are the same. Hopefully everybody has a heart, they have two lungs, they've got two vocal cords. Sometimes they only have one that's functioning, but, you know, we can... assess where someone's at, and I think part of the magic, if you will, of what we do is different from any other vocal coaches, perhaps, is we do a consult that actually assesses where a client is, what they're wanting to do, any problems that they have, kind of assess the physiology find out if there's any problems, any kind of damage issues we're dealing with or a history of that, so that we know what we're putting our hands around, so to speak. Then we actually would personalize or customize, if you will, the instruction to that client instead of doing a kind of a blanket curriculum style of instruction.
So what do you say to a client who has a lot of passion and determination, yet a little real ability or talent?
The truth. I think the truth works. And so, you know, I don't dance around the issues when it comes. I don't have time to dance around what the truth is. If somebody's coming in, I with the assessment, it's about letting them know what the reality is of the work they're going to need to do to be able to progress at a certain level. And the other part of that is I don't make stars. I work with a lot of them, but I don't ever guarantee people, hey, you know, if you do this, you're going to, you know, be a great star, be a great success, because none of us can really predict what the public is going to gravitate towards.
Right.
And that's really what stardom and celebrity is about, is the mass appeal. And nobody can judge that from any amount of talent. I mean, there are a lot of people that aren't talented that are great celebrities. You know what I'm saying?
Right. So the three most important things for success in the music business, what would you say they were?
Mm.
If you could break them down to three.
You know what? Our industry is very difficult to navigate.
Mm-hmm.
So navigational skills, being able to acquire some wisdom and understand what reality is and what it's not, and keeping yourself grounded in the midst of all of the hoo-ha that goes on in the industry is very difficult, I think. Our business is full of opportunities. Therefore, it also attracts a lot of opportunists. And so being able to discern those opportunities that are real and likewise to figure out who the opportunists are who are just trying to exploit you versus really helping you to move from point A to point B.
And I remember reading somewhere, too, that you said that I think you had three T's. Talent, team, and
tenacity.
right. That's what you were just talking about,
Ma'am. It's never about one person. Anytime you see a star the magnitude of an Usher or a Band Perry or Sugarland or a, you know, Jill Scott or Justin Bieber, there are massive numbers of other people that are the support team around that artist that people may never see in the limelight, because the personality, the cult of personality, is about that quote-unquote star. But without the team and without the people that do the support work, those stars would never, ever be able to do what they do. It's too difficult.
Absolutely. You seem to have a way with young artists, especially Justin Bieber, Usher, you know. They all affectionately call you Mama J. Was there something about your own childhood that resonates with them that's touching you, or what? How are you able to make that bridge?
I think that the artists that I work with know. I have often said I am them. They know that I'm an artist. I didn't come into this as a vocal coach. I didn't come into the business to be Mama Jan. I am an artist first, and still am an artist. I still play out now when I want to, and I have 6 albums to my credit and 2 EPs. I own a production studio. I record. And in the productions that I work on with other artists, I'm very actively engaged as a musician and as a singer. I do background vocals and arrange all of that. So I think that they know that I live it. Mm-hmm. I eat it, sleep it, breathe it, and live it every day. And that makes it a little bit more credible, perhaps, because I'm authentic in my artist self as they are.
Mm-hmm. Were there some things that you learned in your experience coming through the industry that you are now teaching them about?
Oh, of course.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And by experience, I think that we learn and we lead that way, that wisdom comes out of experience. Yeah. You can't tell somebody to know something that they don't know. You can always, I can lead a horse to water, but I can't make them walk across it. So people have to do their own walk, but if I can help them to navigate better and to make better choices, that's really kind of where I'm at. And it's not about a judgment of the artist. My artists come in and they come from all walks of life, all walks of lifestyles.
Right.
They make choices on their own, and my job is to give them information so they can make better choices, not to judge what choices they make.
What was the toughest lesson you had to learn? Or maybe you haven't learned it yet. I don't know.
Boundaries.
Boundaries.
Boundaries. I think that as artists, we tend to we push against boundaries. As adolescents, we do that, and as growing artists, we continue to seek and to push against boundaries. And sometimes, if your boundaries are nebulous, as a human being or emotionally or artistically, that can get you into trouble in navigating with other people who may not have good boundaries too. So recognizing that.
Boundaries could mean anything from staying away from the drugs to...
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, I think, and I've lived my life and have learned that way too, and making choices, making better choices to be healthier, and to be more sound in my walk, so that so I do walk my walk and talk my talk. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to be an example, if God is going to hold me accountable for my representation or my example, then I have to take that serious. And so it also involves sacrifice for me. My lifestyle, you know, I didn't necessarily know that I wasn't going to have children, and at this point I'm too old to think about that, but because I've always been a career girl, I've always been playing in bands, I've always been motivated that way, there were certain sacrifices right. just, you know, naturally that occurred. I'm not sorry for that. Mm-hmm. I'm grateful for the opportunities I've had, but my life is extremely different because of it.
Do you think young people are willing to make those sacrifices today?
Interesting question. I think that what I see a lot in young people is a sense of entitlement, because my age generation has spoiled their children, and the children have grown up in the luxury of the work of other people, and have not necessarily known, perhaps, the same work ethic. Certainly not of my parents, who grew up in the Depression era. So I've come to appreciate that a lot, and attempt to instill a sense of responsibility that goes along with the money, the fame, the fortune, the attention, so that people understand it's a business and what is here today can be gone tomorrow. So that's a real important question. I appreciate that. I do think that they're willing to work. Artists really do work hard. There's so much that goes into just sustaining a career, that so many people only see that 5 minutes on mm-hmm. MTV or the Billboard Awards or on the Grammys, and what they don't see is the years and years and years of it not working right, it not going well, of people sleeping in their cars and not having enough money to do whatever. So there is a lot of work and a lot of dedication that goes on.
I suspect there has to be a level of realism on their part, too, in terms of, you know, what is the reality, really, that you would be a superstar?
The bottom line is, I always tell my clients this, and it's a statistical fact, that they have the better odds of winning the lottery than they do of becoming a successful star of the magnitude of, like, Justin Bieber. And that's the truth.
I know. So,
but that doesn't stop people from pursuing their dreams, and it shouldn't.
And it shouldn't.
It
right.
shouldn't. I think that people have the right to pursue, and who knows? And who knows who has that, you know, that ticket?
Right, right.
So at the end of the day, it is about the pursuit of happiness, and that's why I say I broker people's dreams all day long, right. because my job is to help them to pursue without the promise of the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, but there is a way for other people to be able to pursue their happiness and to be better at what they do that does actually progress them along that road.
And you have to be critical with them.
I'm pretty well known
yes,
for that.
And
I think, you know, critical and the truth are two different things,
right,
really.
Right.
But yes, my job is critical, because in order to help people be better, I have to sometimes break down certain bad habits that they have and build them up so that their form is better.
Now, what I see in the difference, though, in some criticism, your criticism is very specific.
Can be.
Right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to someone saying, oh, you'll never make it. You know, that's criticism too, but that's the kind of criticism I think people should ignore.
You know, my job really is, I always tell people, knowledge is power, and the application of that is what's going to make you more successful. So being able to assess what someone doesn't know and then filling in those gaps and providing them with the information makes them more powerful at what they're doing.
Now, you've got some very interesting clients. You've worked with some very interesting people. Talk about that a moment, because there was a quote I saw once by you that said that music was an industry where color is not an issue?
Well, what I said is that music itself is colorless. I think that music is truly the universal language for that reason. For me personally, it's interesting that I'm a middle-aged Southern white woman, and, you know, I'm the hip-hoppinest, you know, gal on the planet as far as the clientele that I represent. Right. And I feel like the female version of Forrest Gump sometimes, because mm-hmm. I really am able to walk in places where other people's feet may not tread by virtue of who I am to the clients. And it's a very interesting I laugh often at the places where God takes me to walk, but at the end of the day, music is something that enters our hearts and our minds without our permission, and it is it has the greatest capacity to communicate, to heal, to translate, and to unify than any other force on the planet Earth does. To me, it is as life sustaining to us almost as water. I know that we can't live without water. We can live without food for a certain amount of time. Me personally, I would never want to live without music, and don't know that I could.
Oh, I wouldn't either. You're listening to In Conversation, and I'm your host, Valerie Jackson, speaking with vocal coach and music producer Jan Smith of Atlanta's nationally renowned Jan Smith Studios. We'll be back with Jan after this short break. This is Valerie Jackson, back in conversation this evening with vocal producer Jan Smith, whose high-profile music industry clients range from Justin Bieber to India Arie to Sugar Land to Usher. Let's talk a little bit about the change in technology mm-hmm. in music now. Mm-hmm. It's dazzling. I mean,
it is amazing.
Oh my gosh, you've got such things as auto-tuning, automatically tuning someone, you know, cutting vocals.
I can make anybody sound good. That's right.
You know what? So where is music going in the way of style and lyrics and sound aesthetics if everything can be so automatically controlled now?
No, you know, I think that digital technology, it can be used for us or against us, just like anything else. You know, you can use gunpowder for good reasons or bad reasons. I think that, digital technology provides us and affords us the opportunity to advance what we're doing in recording arts. It's a great tool to use. It's a wonderful thing for me as a producer to be able to quilt together, if you will, a great vocal performance that maybe didn't happen in one take, but happened in seven takes, and I take the best pieces of all of that and put it together in such a way that you never know I was there, but the artist gets to listen to what they're literally capable of doing and using that perhaps as a vocal map to then better their live performances. That's really the way that I see it. As an artist, as a singer myself, I'm not as quick to be supportive of autotune, because I grew up old school where you stood in a booth and if you couldn't stand and deliver, we didn't have those tools, and so mm-hmm. you had to be responsible for knowing how to sing. So as a coach, one of my platforms, if you will, or things that I preach on is helping those artists to be responsible. Don't be dependent. Don't be one of those artists that leans into technology so much to where you can't stand and deliver live in a room, and be who you say you are. So I think more than anything, we're seeing that. Mm-hmm. We're seeing those people who are emerging as the real artists, who are bankable artists, who are using technology to their advantage, but who are not dependent upon it.
I was just going to say, wouldn't this new software or new technology have a tendency maybe to make artists lazy?
Of course it does.
You know?
If they choose to be lazy, if they choose to be, but then if they're coming to see me, they're not going to get away with that very long.
Okay.
I think that there are more people than you realize who are seeking to better you know, better themselves as artists, and to use those things as tools, not as crutches. I don't want it to be present in the performance. And so that, to me, is the real art of a producer, is to make great records. And that's what people are used to listening to now. They're used to listening to great records that are well produced, but that also does not necessarily highlight the technology versus the art.
Hmm. What about jobs, though? I mean, auto-tuning, things like that. I understand that you can produce vocal background vocals with that. And so does that mean you don't need background vocals anymore?
You know what? You can take it to that degree if you want to. I mean, there are people that, you know, with Logic and Ableton and Pro Tools, they all have presets, and there's lots of there's a ton of sounds that I can pull from and create a whole track and never have to use any other musicians if I don't want to, much less myself as a musician.
But is that really music then?
Well, it's creativity.
Well,
it's creativity,
yeah, okay,
for sure. And yes, it's music.
Yeah.
It is music.
Yeah.
It's a creative art form. It's a different kind of creative art form. I like the hybrid version of being able to have access to different sounds and some of the fun digital technology that we have. And then I still like to walk in a booth and sing real background vocals and have real artists come in and have a real cellist and real drummers play on stuff. I mean, I love that.
We've got the new technology in production. What are we doing in distribution that's new?
Interesting. Interesting. That's how technology has really affected us the most, I think, especially in the music industry. And I'm an active voting member of the Recording Academy, so and an active participant in the recording industry. So those elements of distribution have, I think that we're going to see brick-and-mortar stores will become a thing of the past, although mm-hmm. your audiophiles will always be in existence. I mean, I still have, I've got the big gramophones in my house.
Right.
I mean, I've still got the old Victrolas where you hand wind it, and I've got a real old masters of Benny Goodman and things like that. So I'm an audiophile too and collect records. The old, recording on Studer, heads and doing 2.5-inch
right.
tape, and we're kind of past that at this point. There are great things to still take with us from those sounds. That's why certain technologies are so great in modern recording, because we can still use both the old and the new to have great recordings. But there are certain aspects of recording that are kind of no longer. And I think the thing will happen with distribution to where you get in your car and you have a flash drive, or everything will be loaded down from the cloud. You won't even need a flash drive.
What does this new distribution system do with respect to the artist, affecting him? Does that mean he has to perform a different way now, or record a different way?
Not so much perform and record, but I think that distribution, the technical industry has definitely gotten ahead of, sales and marketing distribution. So the industry's having to kind of catch up, because when things started being downloaded,
right.
all of a sudden, it did diffuse the process of the earnings. And what began to happen is the money got taken away from the artist. And I do believe that we're getting back to being able to see artists have their own control of that, which mm-hmm. is a great thing. I think technology has maybe put more money back in the hands of artists, which
well,
is where
good.
It belongs.
Yeah.
But
who's making most of the money now?
Well, I mean,
who
the industry, the corporate conglomerates
the big companies,
they were. Our industry's hemorrhaging right now,
yeah.
trying to figure all that out.
Right.
But I do think it's there's a leveling of the playing field that has happened, and distribution is kind of like with YouTube now and with all.
I was just going to say YouTube. I mean, you could go on YouTube with a song, and all of a sudden,
sure.
overnight, you know,
absolutely can happen that way,
right.
and it also waters down the process, though, because now you have a plethora of I mean, just millions of people who are out there. So how can you swim in that sea?
Okay. So how do young artists today have the staying power of a Frank Sinatra or Ella Fitzgerald, if that's even possible?
I think it's possible. I mean, there are definitely artists that have staying power. I think that Usher has had an incredible career. I think Justin Timberlake has had an incredible career, and there are artists. Jill Scott,
right.
Kimberly Perry, the band Perry. There are artists who have been at it for a minute and who continue to be at it and have that success. And mostly, what it has to do with is how well they relate to their fan base. and how long their, you know, fans feel supportive of what they're doing. That's as long as they're creating good art. So I'm not going to support it if it's. I'm not going to continue to buy records if I don't like what somebody's doing.
So how important is the whole social media thing and media, visual media?
Very. Social media is one of those technology platforms that has occurred within the last, you know, several years that has just all of a sudden become a part of the visibility of any artist and also the way that they are staying active with their fans. And that's how you keep them engaged in what you're doing. You can look at it how you want to. I'm very active on all those platforms, and if anybody out there wants to find me, I'm ATLVOX. You find Mama Jan or Atlanta Vox. That's who I am.
So who are your most difficult clients? I don't mean by name, but by type.
I guess the best way to answer that would be the people who either think that they don't need to hear or don't, you know, that they've got it all together. It's kind of like, well, what are you doing here anyway? People who are struggling with substance abuse are difficult because you're dealing with an addiction and you know, that gets in the way of people's progress physically and otherwise, you know, because your body is your instrument. And so if somebody's failing physically in those areas, then it becomes an issue. I think that the other difficult thing, it's not so much the client, but when circumstances around them, when you see situations where people have gotten into bad business deals and things and they're kind of stuck there, it's disheartening, and there's no real way to pull them out of that other than to say, hey, this is where you are, and kind of persevering through it may be the only option that they have. So it's not really, I don't deal with a lot of difficulty in people.
Do you have to go back and use your psychology degree sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
All the time, huh?
Yes, ma'am. On a daily basis, that comes into play.
For 5 years, you worked within the Academy to help bring about recognition for vocal producers as Grammy recipients. Mm-hmm. You're one of the few vocal coaches, producers, who've ever been credited on a multi-platinum recording. Mm-hmm. So why is it important that vocal producers...
I think that there was a time when people who produced records, the producer was the person who did all of that. And then music began to, you know, expand, and the opportunities for people to work in the studio expanded with that. And it became more of a collaborative art form, production has, in some respects. I think that there is still an executive producer or someone who's responsible for the project. But, you know, you have a lot of people working on albums. And what, in my case, going into studios and working with my artist, I wasn't just vocal coaching them at that point. If the producer left the room, I was actually, you know, working with them on the delivery of them vocally in the studio, making the product, helping to be in a production role, and even, you know, working with the engineers and comping the vocals, and then having someone else take credit for that. So my goal within the Academy, and, you know, I still serve the Academy, but was very, very active as a trustee and the president of the Atlanta chapter for well over 20 years, but that it took 5 years of my life on this particular platform to get other people, even in the Academy, to recognize that work that was going. Now everybody kind of like, okay, we get it. But it was like people didn't quite understand, and producers in particular were very, very slow to give up that. It's like, well, you know, because they had to give up some of their points.
Money.
Well, points,
what?
Points and credit.
What is points?
Points interprets into money.
Okay,
yes, it does.
But then again, you were the one who was actually pulling out the talent and making possible what the people were listening to the record to hear.
Yes, and that's also part of the reason why I built my own production room and started doing production myself, because I didn't want to be dependent on other people to say, you know, what I was doing in the room. And so if people come to me now for production, then we're real clear about what they're coming to me for.
It's production.
Absolutely.
Opposed to what?
Vocal coaching.
Right, okay.
And I think that, and it's all about relationships too. I love the producers that I've worked with, not only on my own albums, but who I've been, you know, called in to work with their artist and been a vocal coach, I don't have a problem staying in my place as far as understanding that. But if you ask me to walk across that line, then you are also going to credit me with that work.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what my work with the Academy was to make sure that that was insured, not just for me, but for other vocal producers who were doing the same thing.
Great. That's great. Mm-hmm. And they should all say, thank you, Miss Jane.
Mama
Jane.
I hope they do. I hope they do.
Joining me in the studio this evening in conversation is Grammy-nominated vocal producer Jan Smith. In the next segment, we'll talk about how Jan used lessons from her own life and her spiritual walk to do her unique work with some of the most famous music industry artists in America. Talk to you about being a Christian woman in the mm-hmm. music industry. Mm-hmm. Now, you've worked with some hardcore rappers. Is it difficult to work in an industry that can be vulgar at times in lyrics and behavior? As a Christian, how do you reconcile the two worlds?
It's a good question, a hard question. Being in the world and not of it is difficult. And I didn't always live my life in accordance with God's law. I have walked in many different aspects of the world. And I'm not sorry for that, but understanding that and having lived through a lot of my own shortcomings and choices that may not have served very well, and then knowing the difference allows me, I think, a greater way of being able to speak into the lives of other people. And I don't think that means that I have to sit there and, thump a Bible over folks' heads. And it's not about judgment. When you think about the walk of Christ, it's extremely difficult. It's extremely difficult not to judge other people, but to allow them the freedom to be who they are and love them in spite of that. And God has done a mighty work in my life. God's done a mighty work in my life and has shown me and given me the heart to be able to embrace people and to meet them where they are so that I can help them be better. It's not my agenda to save the rest of the world and make them Christians or make them believe as I do. If they do, I think that's great, and I can share that, and I do that openly. But I also think that it's about letting other people be who they are and letting my light shine. Being salt and light in the world is so much greater than just pouring a bag of salt over somebody's open wound.
I'm thinking now about your relationship with maybe some of the artists who are not manifesting a Christian lifestyle, so mm-hmm. to speak. What I'm hearing you say is you're not trying, are you trying to, and when I say convert, I don't mean to Christianity, I mean to change. So are you trying to, do you try to use your Christian base when you looking at how they may need to change or if there is a need for change?
Of course. Of course, because that's what I believe, and that's the heart of who I am. I think that how that is presented is a big flaw in a lot of spiritually good people who mean well, but who may not understand or be willing to be open to hearing the other side, where people are coming from. That's why I said meeting people where they are.
You've written a book, as a matter of fact, based on some of your
My fall
religious
from grace.
Experiences.
it's
called Run the Other Way.
Yes,
so
ma'am.
Talk to us about your writings on your spiritual beliefs.
You know what? I've always been a writer since I was a kid, writing poems and writing songs. That's where this all started for me. So when things happen in my life, good, bad, or indifferent, you know, cathartically writing is a part of what I've always done. And it's not really been for other people's consumption. Songs kind of happened that way, but, you know, just writing has always been my way of expressing. I write letters to people. I write cards because I feel like I write better than I talk, frankly. My particular fall from grace came with the lack of boundaries that I was talking about earlier, and lack of boundaries in relationships, and I became involved with one of my musicians who happened to be a married man, and we stayed engaged in an adulterous affair for well over 10 years. In the year 2000, it became apparent that God was going to call me on the carpet, but it was just. You know, God speaking to my heart that I needed to change what I was doing, and I needed to bring my life into accordance with what it needed to be obedient and also to surrender a lot of who I thought I was to become who I am in God's eyes. And so the book Run the Other Way is a collection of some of those cathartic writings that occurred off and on throughout that 10-year period and certainly the 2 years after the demise of that relationship and the work that God did in my life to really bring me into who I truly am for His glory and not for mine.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for Jan Smith? What do you want to do that you haven't done already?
I don't know. I often say that if I won the lottery today, I would be at my studio tomorrow, and I would be because the money would just be piling it higher and deeper. It just let me do more for more people, honestly. Mm-hmm.
But do you have a nonprofit organization?
The Bridge Music
Foundation, is that still?
Yes, ma'am. It is, and it's a there are other great organizations too. That mostly what it is an effort to help other artists. And to be able to, seek the nonprofit money for people if they want to be angel donors to help other artists to be able to pursue their goals when they may not have the money to do that.
So they would have a studio time gratis, or they
right,
would
or
be
vocal
able to,
lessons, or maybe help to mm-hmm. fill put gas in their tank. You mm-hmm. know, if they get stuck on the road, that kind mm-hmm. of thing.
In 2011, you were inducted into the Georgia Music Hall of Fame, presented with the Chairman's Award.
Yes, ma'am.
Very outstanding. Mm-hmm. So if you didn't do music, what would you be doing?
Some form of creativity, for sure. Writing, and cutting grass. I love. I've got some acreage, and I love to cut grass because it allows me to really think through and. Nobody can really reach me on the phone, and I have that time alone with God to really to work through some stuff. But taking care of my mom is a priority. And
she's still with you.
She is. She's 86
Great.
Years old, and she's
Bless
a fireball,
her heart.
Buddy.
Bless her heart.
Helping other people. I would be
mm-hmm.
helping other people.
Mm-hmm. The someone once asked me about. I told them I was interviewing you, and they said, "I wonder how much." Whether you can make a living being a vocal coach.
Yes, you can.
You can?
Absolutely, you can.
And, well, what do you have to do, though, to be, you can, because you've paid
well,
your
I
dues.
Well, I can, and seven other
you know.
People in my studio can, and, mm-hmm. and that's what I said.
Well, what does one have to do to be able to be a vocal coach at Jan Smith Studios?
Stand in line. No, you know what? It's an interesting culture again, and I don't take any credit for that because it wasn't my idea. I didn't just I didn't say, hey, I'm gonna have a vocal studio. I never thought in a million years I'd be doing what I'm doing. But in that it's been created through me and has provided opportunities for others, it is a very delicate culture. So the fit is important, the people and how they relate to other folks, and if they actually adapt to the same methodology that we do and how we approach teaching clients.
Mm, mm. Any special education or skills needed?
At this point, yes. I'm the only person on staff that doesn't have a degree in music.
Oh, really?
Believe it or not. Yeah.
You mean an official degree, huh?
Correct. Yeah, mine's in psychology. But my staff are very well educated in music and arts, and that wasn't really a prerequisite when I, you know, I, there were just so many people, I couldn't see them all. So then I trained a protege, and then there were two, and then there were three, and now there are seven. So, you know, scaling the business at this point, and we've got over 400 people waiting to get in, and it's a blessing, but it's also a problem.
Right.
So, figuring that out has been a real business jump for me, and recognizing the fact and embracing the fact that it is a business, that it's, you know, it's hard for me sometimes to deal with that part of it when I love just being with the people.
Who's coming to you for vocal coaching? I mean, professionals, hobbyists?
All the above.
Really?
All the above. I mean, my schedule at this point is reserved predominantly for our national and touring artists, and those artists that are being developed by labels that you may not know today, but you will hear about them tomorrow because they're the ones that have just been signed that are being tooled up. And then we have people who want to sing better for their church choirs. They want to have, you know, they want to perform in a local play. They, you know, they might be on worship teams in local churches. They might be playing in clubs. They're in bands. They, you know, they're rapping. They're doing poetry, you know, mm-hmm. you know, read-offs. I mean, it's all of that.
Mm-hmm. Have your experiences working with some of those well-known singers given you insights into the expectations or the limitations of performing artists, especially those who find themselves in such popular demand, you know, to sing and dance?
Yes. Yes, it has. It has also made me keeping up with them and being called out on tour and doing tour preps and doing promo circuit tours and things like that. It's also made me maintain my level of, you know, physical exercise and training and making sure that I can, you know, keep up and keeping my health at a certain level too, so that I have the energy to be, because I'm on the road. I just got back from New York City,
mm-hmm.
Was up there on rehearsals and doing a live showcase. So my energy has to stay there too.
That's interesting.
I don't dance. I mean, right. I'm not doing right. that part of the choreography. I'm not having to do that, but I am, you know, with them 10 hours a day, sometimes 16. So, it requires my stamina too.
Who makes the rules in terms of?
There are no rules.
No.
Our business, it is whatever it is, and it is demanding. It is, you move here, you go there.
So you can't tell someone, you can't do another show. You need to wait.
I'm famous for pulling the plug on the New York State Fair show for Justin Bieber. That's on
really?
Film. That's on a Paramount movie. You know, yes, we canceled the show because I had to have him down for 3 days to be able to get him to vocally to the point to where he was going to be able to do the shoot that we did the movie at Madison Square Gardens, which was one of the biggest shows of his life at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to give him some steroids to get his vocal cords not to be swollen, so he had to not sing for 3 days. So I had to pull the plug on a show. 17,000 tickets were sold.
Whoa.
So it was mm-hmm. I'll definitely go there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If it's to save your client.
It's hard. It's hard for entertainers to say no. Everybody has that mentality. The show must go on. Myself included. So it's really hard not to push through and to do. So knowing when to say no mm-hmm. is a really hard thing to learn.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Well, on that note, what do you do for fun?
You
have time for fun?
Well, I mean, it's kind of hard for me to answer that question just because I'm having fun right now.
Your life, what you're doing, you're enjoying,
I get paid for being who I am. I don't know any greater luxury, and so I do it with a vengeance. I'm happy. I mm-hmm. love what I do. Mm-hmm. I thrive best helping other people, and being able to create and make music mm-hmm. is my life, and so I don't want for much.
What do you think is needed in the music industry today with respect to
inspiration?
Yes, okay.
I believe that people in general need to be inspired. I believe that we as human beings want to be inspired, that it gives us hope. And I believe that we need inspiration and hope in our industry.
Mm. Why do you think we don't have more of it now?
I don't think that we don't have it. Mm-hmm. I just think that we need more of it.
Okay. Then.
You know,
okay,
I don't think that we don't have inspiration and mm-hmm. that we don't have hope. I just think that those are the offsprings of creativity. And I think without creativity, And I don't mean just in music. I'm talking about art. Without those, culture dies. And I believe that, you know, if we continue to take music and art for granted and dilute it to the point to where it becomes unimportant.
And taking it out of our schools. I can't believe they're taking music out of schools.
Yeah, I think that that's a really, I think that's a bad mistake.
Big mistake.
And I think that we are going to see, I think we are already seeing the results of that.
I think a lot of the disruption, the violence and whatnot is a result of people, young people not having creative ways to release all of that pent-up energy and imagination.
I agree. 100%.
Well, my dear, if you can advise young or even older musicians, for that matter, if you could, what piece of advice would you give someone who really is interested in being a vital part of the music industry?
Exactly that, to be a part of a vital music industry. Not to wait on other people to do things for you, but to jump in with both feet. There is no such thing as try. We either do or we do not. That's the
Yoda. How do you do that if you don't have money to pay a producer or whatever?
Not what about that. You can sing. Singing is free. Singing is free. Air is free. Breathing is free. You know, I think that being creative, you know, looking in your area for those ways and things and events. There's all kinds of things going on. There's people always creating. There's ways that you can get involved and begin to kind of find out where those pockets are, find out where the music is that you love, find out where the bands are that play that you want to hear their music. There are organizations, there are songwriting organizations, there's, you know, studios like Jan Smith Studios, and there are people that hang out there. I mean, there are music stores. I mean, there are places where you can find musicians and creative people. And it's not always about spending money. I do know that it does take money to be able to do things professionally and to move into that part of when art and commerce meet. But at the end of the day, it's about you got to start somewhere.
Right. Well, my dear, I'm sure you've given many young people a great start, and I thank you very much for that.
My privilege and my honor.
Thank you so much for sharing with us today.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
I appreciate all that you do.
Thank you.
Talking to Jan Smith, taking care of business.
My pleasure.
Thanks for joining us this evening. You can listen to this and other episodes of In Conversation by visiting our audio archive online at wabe.org/inconversation. This series is a production of WABE FM 90.1 and Public Broadcasting Atlanta. The producer for this program is Marjorie Greenbaum, the technical producer, Mike Johns, editor, Melissa Terry. Programming support by Lois Reitzis and Dave Bereswain. Until next time, this is Valerie Jackson in Conversation. Good night.